Science has always had its detractors, but we're reaching a point right now in this country where it has opposition to science has practically become national policy.
Until the day that the THAAD system is withdrawn from South Korea, the Kimcheon residents, the Won Buddhist, and the Sangju residents will continue to fight.
Welcome to On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance from the nation's capital, produced for WPFW Pacifica Radio in Washington, D.C. I'm Esther Ivarum, and on today's packed show, Voices Offstage at the March for Science, which kicked off this entire week of actions in D.C. leading to Saturday's People's Climate March. We'll hear voices of those in the trenches of hospitals, of saving an environment habitable for humans. Also, it's the fourth Friday, and I'm excited to have hopefully my first of many extended conversations about media and culture with Janine Jackson, host of the nationally syndicated show Counterspin. All that is coming up later in the show, but first our headlines and a look at this week with writer and activist Gerald Horn, professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston. Welcome back to the show, Gerald. This week is an important marker in D.C. with a huge march on Earth Day and another expected tomorrow, Saturday, for the People's Climate March, and still another on Monday, May Day, focused on workers and labor. Of course, Saturday also marks the 100th day of Trump in office. So I want to give you time to talk about your thoughts about this marker for the Trump administration.
With his seeking to back away from NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, is causing Mexico to reorient its trade. Mexico is going to be seeking to reduce its agricultural imports from the Midwest of the United States and reorient towards both Brazil and Argentina. Likewise, if the United States moves to force GM and Ford to withdraw from Mexico, Mexico has already moved to have Chinese auto manufacturers take their place. Likewise, when Theresa May, the British Prime Minister, visited Washington as one of the first visitors who met with Mr. Trump, the idea was, according to some, that this would lead to an Anglo-U.S. alliance targeting the European Union, which Britain is in the process of withdrawing from. But this, in turn, has caused the EU to restart talks with Russia. Keep a close eye on the visit of Chancellor Merkel to Moscow to meet with Vladimir Putin within the next few days. So in some ways, the international climate is changing, and this could be good news for the progressive movement if it pays attention.
Well, this week also, Trump summoned 100 senators to the White House for a briefing about North Korea, and Senator Bernie Sanders refused to go. But does this signal that visit or this invitation is Trump's version of getting congressional approval to strike North Korea? I've been really concerned that it seems like Trump is abdicating the civilian oversight role of the military to the Pentagon.
Well, that is a very worthwhile comment on your part. Even the New York Times a few days ago pointed to the fact that Mr. Trump has abdicated responsibility and has turned over the keys to the national security state to the military. That has led to certain miscalculations. The dropping of the so-called mother of all bombs on Afghanistan helped to make the leaders of North Korea more nervous than they ordinarily are. And likewise, this talk about sending the aircraft carrier Carl Vinson northward to North Korea, when actually it was not headed in that direction, also shows a lack of coordination with regard to the White House and the military. Revolutionary movements have always suggested that politics should be in command, not the military. Even the U.S. Constitution says likewise, because the president is the commander-in-chief.
Right.
When that is not the case, it leads to a warping of priorities, because for the military, it is a hammer, and therefore every problem is a nail, and it tends to shy away from diplomatic solutions and tends to lean towards military solutions, and that, of course, could spell catastrophe.
Well, in almost all of the coverage about North Korea, we in this country don't get to hear the voices of Koreans. Recently, I attended a talk by the Reverend Sonjoy Kim, co-chair of the Sonju Struggle Committee to Stop THAAD Deployment in South Korea. She actually lives in the community where the U.S. has just recently said it is moving ahead to deploy the controversial THAAD system. And there were actually mass protests in that community this week. And so the committee says that the THAAD system won't protect them, but will make them a target for attack, that living in close proximity to powerful radar is toxic, and the THAAD location is actually desecrating a sacred Buddhist shrine. I want to play a comment from Reverend Kim and then get you to comment. She's speaking through an interpreter earlier this month in D.C.
I hope the message could be to Trump and also the Defense Secretary Mattis that the South Korean people do not want weapons of war. What we want is peace, reunification, and dialogue with North Korea. And I hope that this could lead to an opportunity for a different kind of policy towards peace.
Yeah, so that was the Reverend Sonjoy Kim speaking earlier. What about the latest in North Korea, Gerald?
Well, I think what the Trump administration is trying to do is influence the elections in South Korea. An election is coming up shortly. The left-wing candidate was surging the polls but began to lose altitude once this crisis in North Korea began. And I think that once the election is over, hopefully you'll see a lessening of the tensions on the Korean Peninsula. But the other part of this equation is that this North Korean crisis is also splitting the top leadership of the Chinese Communist Party, according to Taiwanese sources. That is to say that there is a wing of the leadership that's very close to the DPRK, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, or North Korea, and a wing that would like to throw them overboard. When Mr. Trump continually praises President Xi for his intervention in the North Korean crisis, he is really putting pressure on the Chinese Communist Party and trying to split the leadership. And I don't think that will end anytime soon.
Well, also this week, you know, the hits just keep on coming with this Trump administration, you know, a possibility of repealing net neutrality, opening up monuments to corporate drilling. So even with all of that, is there any little known news this week?
Well, as a historian, I'd like to look at the past. That is to say that liberals, the Congressional Black Caucus leadership, the NAACP leadership at all, they all tell us that their goal is to make the United States live up to its ideals. That is to say, the ideals supposedly embodied in the Constitution. Even Gil Scott-Heron, the late songwriter and artist, in his Winter in America spoke well of the United States Constitution. But the question is, what if they're wrong? What if the ideals that are being preserved are not noble, but actually slavery and dispossessing the indigenous? And what I find striking is that mainstream historians lately have come to that conclusion. I'm speaking of Michael Klarman of Harvard Law School in his new book, The Framers' Coup, published by Oxford University Press, and Alan Taylor, twice a Pulitzer Prize winner at the University of Virginia, in his new book, American Revolutions. Taylor comes to the conclusion that the overthrow of British rule was all about taking the land of the Native Americans and enslaving more Africans, whereas Klarman comes to the conclusion that the Constitution, instead of helping to inscribe these noble ideals, was actually a way to repress popular revolt, as represented in Shays' Rebellion in Massachusetts at the time the Constitution was being framed. What this tells us, of course, is that we're in deeper trouble than we first feared. Because I think that when you see that folks will not change their political line in light of new revelations and in light of reality, it tells us that we're deeply enmeshed in a systemic crisis, and therefore there seems to be no end in sight.
Well, on that not-so-positive note, we'll have to end our conversation today, but we'll pick it up next week, if not sooner. I've been speaking with prolific author and activist Gerald Horn, professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston. Thanks for joining me, Gerald.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, another area where the U.S. continues to meddle abroad is in South America. This week, Venezuela took the unexpected step of withdrawing from the Organization of American States after what they described as continued illegal actions taken by the head of the OAS, Luis Almagro, to undermine the elected government of President Maduro. I recently spoke to Carlos Ron, minister counselor for the Venezuelan embassy here in Washington, D.C. So what's happening in Venezuela that people here should know about?
Well, during the last few weeks, we've been undergoing a new series of violent protests spurred by the opposition who, in face of losing popularity for some of its leaders, in face of also gaining support from outside, particularly from the Organization of American States, where Secretary General Luis Almagro conducted an illegal session attempting to condemn Venezuela and to apply sanctions, that has emboldened the opposition in Venezuela and has led to violent protests again, like the ones we saw in 2014, aimed at destabilizing the government and trying to get rid of President Maduro.
Tell me about the illegal session.
Well, it was a session that was, first of all, it should have been presided by Bolivia, who now has the chair of the Permanent Council of the OAS. But Bolivia did not conduct the session because the prior discussion that should take place had not taken place. So Bolivia suspended the session, and they went to the vice chair, who is Haiti, to try to still get the session going. Haiti also did not take on the session. So finally, they went to a third country, Honduras, that agreed to hold the session illegally, given that, you know, it was up to the chair or the vice chair to lead the session. And during that session, they approved, also illegally, a resolution aimed at condemning Venezuela, calling Venezuela, or saying that Venezuela is no longer a democracy, and calling for immediate elections, which would be in violation of our constitution. That resolution needed at least 18 votes to be approved. And first of all, it needed to be in a legal session, but furthermore, like, they didn't have hold the vote. They actually said that they were approved by consensus when there was only 17 countries approving the vote that would have approved the resolution at the time. There was obvious abstentions that they were voiced by four countries, and even so, de facto president, the chair of Honduras, accepted the resolution, and the OAS says now that it was actually approved when it was illegal.
So what is, the government doing in response to just kind of keep the peace or to maintain order?
Well, what it's always been doing, first of all, calling for, peaceful protest is something guaranteed by our constitution, and that's definitely allowed. So anybody that has a concern and wants to voice it can do it peacefully, but not, you know, with violence acts. I mean, the things that have been going on is, you know, there's been burning of public buildings, there have been attacks on people, there were attacks on police officers. You know, there was actually a group at one point that entered shooting into one of the housing projects that was made during President Chavez's government. And actually, out of that shooting, a young boy of, you know, 14 years old died, you know, as a result. So these are all violent acts that they've been perpetrating, trying to, again, destabilize the government, trying to undermine President Maduro's authority, and trying to set up things in a way to make it seem through the mainstream media and through other outlets around the world that it's actual repression from the government that's taking place and not that their violent actions are causing all this.
Now, you also said that they are being encouraged by not just by the OAS, but by the Trump administration.
Well, definitely, you see that every time the U.S. authorities take stands, you know, in meddling into Venezuela's internal affairs, that causes some, that turns into a green light for these violent groups and for these protests to take place. For example, you had statements encouraging, actually encouraging the protests to take place, statements For example, the embassy in Caracas issued a warning, such as like a travel warning to their citizens, saying that Venezuela was going to undergo a series of protests this week. Now, not only was there a warning about that the protests could be violent, but they actually laid out the whole schedule of where the protests were going to be, at what time, the protests would entail. So, in a way, that's sort of putting out the information and serving as some sort of a promoter of those activities.
Ron noted that 15 years ago, the people of Venezuela took to the streets to defend their constitution and to revert the coup against the democratically elected government of President Hugo Chavez. And he said that they are ready to again defend the rights of their sovereign country. In D.C. news, activists fighting to save affordable housing for working people in the district attended an important hearing this week. Chantel James has more.
On Monday the 23rd, the D.C. Zoning Commission spoke only very briefly on the subject of whether Mid-City Financial would be permitted to continue with its plans to displace the working class residents of Northeast D.C. complex Brooklyn Manor. But the tens of activists who had come out to make their presence felt to the powers that be, many of whom were organized by local economic and racial justice champion 1DC, left feeling that forward progress had been made and that their voices had not fallen on the deaf ears of the city. Ultimately, the commission, led by Chairman Anthony Hood, came to the decision that they would postpone a final ruling for the 22nd of next month. That gives 1DC and the courageous residents of Brooklyn Manor a bit more time to regroup and strategize. After the hearing had concluded, Brooklyn Manor residents and their supporters huddled outside of 1 Judiciary Square to debrief. Brooklyn Manor resident Cheryl Brunson made clear the importance of keeping residency in the district and refusing to be displaced.
I am a grandmother who is raising my grandkids at Brooklyn Manor.
I am.
And, right. And with that comes, it's called a grandparent program. It's set up for grandparents like myself. Here's the deal. I will not get that grant if I do not live in Washington, D.C.
That's right.
If I have to move to Maryland or Virginia, that's taking clothes and food off of my table and off of my grandkids' backs.
That's right.
Hell no.
I know that.
We won't go. Hell no. We won't go. Hell no. We won't go. Hell no. We won't go.
To learn more about the work of Yasmina Marabit, who organizes tenants at Brooklyn Manor, or the work of others at 1DC, visit their website at www.1dconline.org. From Judiciary Square, this is Chantal James.
Also in D.C., there's actually a special program tonight addressing Trump's first 100 days and the African-American community. And that's, I believe, at 7 p.m. at the Metropolitan AME Church on M Street in Northwest D.C. And those are our headlines and happenings. When we come back, the subjects are WikiLeaks, Julian Assange being threatened with arrest, how the new Cold War is impacting media, and much more. Stay with us. For longtime listeners to this and other Pacifica stations, you recognize that last sound as the theme music for Counterspin, a radio program produced by Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting and hosted by my next guest, Janine Jackson, who I hope to convince to join us regularly for this segment. Welcome to On the Ground, Janine.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, let's jump right in. Counterspin has been providing critical examination of major stories every week. And by its own definition, it exposes what the mainstream media might have missed in their coverage. So I want to ask you first, what have you been focusing on in April?
Well, I'm thinking about last week where we were looking at Wells Fargo, for example. That one's really stuck with me because it's a story about banks that we all remember, those predatory loans that really sunk a lot of families, took a lot of money from folks. And mm-hmm. as my guest, Saki Bhatti, was explaining, were really racist. A lot of folks think that scandal's behind us, and media sort of treat it like it's behind us, but it's not behind us. Folks are still dealing with it, and so I was excited to learn about what folks are doing in terms of activism around Wells Fargo, trying to get them to dump their board of directors, for example, and trying to get them to change their practices. You know, it's not just private prisons. It's also the Dakota Access Pipeline. I mean, if there's something that's hurting communities of color, Wells Fargo is involved in it, it seems. So that was a story that, you know, media had talked about, but they hadn't really dug into, in particular, the racism that was involved in their practices. And so I was happy to be able to shed some more light on that and to let folks know that, you know, folks are doing something. Folks are doing something about this. It's not that we're throwing up our hands in frustration. Folks are actually out in the street.
D.C. is one of those sites of activism because there's a big movement here to get D.C. to divest from Wells Fargo. And there's a big D.C. divest campaign that draws in not only the issue of the Dakota Access Pipeline, but as you said, it's racist policies around the mortgage loan crisis and the private prison industry. And then right up the 95 in Baltimore, people are still feeling the effects from how Wells Fargo devastated that city.
Absolutely. And one of the things that we talked about on Counterspin was that folks are not necessarily looking at the national level, but they are looking at places like D.C., where the city itself or the state level in Illinois, where they can divest at that level, at a local level. And I think that's exciting for activists, too, that you can get in at a lower level. It doesn't have to always be writing to Congress, you know, or that sort of thing. You can do something in your community, and it actually can have an impact. So D.C. is a great example where the city itself can divest, and I'm happy to hear that folks are working on that.
So there's certain things that have been really bugging me about media this month. The most recent thing that happened is this possibility that the United States is trying to develop some type of warrant to arrest Assange, Julian Assange of WikiLeaks. And I mean, this is troubling on so many different levels. First of all, he's not a U.S. citizen. So I'm trying to figure out how they think they have the right to, like, arrest him. Secondly, this man is in the proud tradition of whistleblowers, and it seems that he's gotten caught up in this whole Russiagate situation in the sense that, you know, they want to say he committed a crime by telling people the truth. So I want to get your thoughts on that, because I know it's more complicated than that, but it just goes to the heart of what the media is supposed to be about.
You know, it both is and is not more complicated than that, Esther. I think in some ways it's quite simple. You know, you don't have to like Julian Assange, you don't have to like WikiLeaks, but we do need to recognize that if it's a crime to reveal things that the government wants to label secret, then we are making the government solely in charge of the information that we are able to receive. That's
right.
A very dangerous proposition. And if you are going to criminalize WikiLeaks, then you have to, in the same stroke, be criminalizing the New York Times and the Washington Post. You know, that's what journalists do, is get information often that powerful people don't want to have revealed and to let the people know about it. That's the job of journalism. If we decide that it's criminal to reveal information because the state doesn't want you to reveal it, then we've got a very serious problem. And I think folks should separate whatever feelings they have about Assange as a person and recognize that we really are talking about criminalizing information. And that's a very
right.
dangerous place to be in.
And I think similarly, I do watch RT. There are a number of shows on there, including Tom Hartman, watching the Hawks. They have a comedy show that I watch sometimes. They have a show coming out of London, Going Underground. There are a number of shows on there that I consider presenting. Oh, Chris Hedges has a show on RT now, and that's Russia Today. And they have a number of shows that I think present a perspective that you're not hearing on what is so-called liberal media, like MSNBC. And so to see RT vilified, one congresswoman got up recently and made a presentation and called it a propaganda arm of Russia and tried to, again, in this whole Russiagate scenario, paint it as kind of a criminal operation. So where do you see RT in the media landscape that you watch and how it's being portrayed?
Well, I like that you use the word landscape, and I think that's actually key. Look, RT is state media. You know, that's, it's not wrong to say that it is, in the same way that Voice of America is state media for the United States. That doesn't mean that there can't be a showcase for good journalism. You know, that doesn't mean that everything that comes from that is propaganda that you shouldn't trust. Do I want all of my media outlets to be state-owned? No, absolutely not. But is there a place for that in the landscape? Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think in particular, first of all, this whole new Cold War we're living through is ridiculous. I mean, people getting excited about Russia like they really want to go to war with Russia. I mean, are we in the 1950s again? I thought we'd kind of come through that, you know. So that vilification of Russian media in particular, I think, is kind of absurd. But I think we need a landscape where we've got some state media, some private media, some public media, some that's a combination. One of the things that we always point out at FAIR and with Counterspin is that ownership does matter. It really does matter who owns the media outlet. And that's why we need a kind of mixed landscape in terms of ownership. And I think RT would absolutely have a place in that. And particularly because, you know, the idea that only state media produce propaganda, well, we know better than that. We know that corporations can call themselves independent and be just as propagandistic as they want to be. You know, it's just with
exactly.
a different ideology behind it, you know. So I, as a media critic, folks want me to say, this is the good outlet and these are bad. And it just doesn't work that way. You've got to keep those critical skills working in your brain, whether you're reading a blog or the New York Times. You've got to always be asking questions, whether it's state media, whether it's private media. You've always got to be asking, what's not being talked about here? Who's not being spoken to here? And, you know, RT fills a void, I think, because it is okay on RT to be critical of the U.S. government. And by golly, we certainly need media that feel comfortable being critical of the U.S. government, because there's a heck of a lot to criticize.
It's actually kind of caused a split in my household, because, like, you know, when 9 o'clock comes, you know, I cannot listen to Rachel Maddow. And Lawrence, I mean, and I used to at some point kind of enjoy it to some extent. And, you know, thank God that the basketball playoffs are on now, because now it provides some like common ground.
We can all meet. We can all meet over basketball. Well, you know, a household watching different news, I think, can be healthy, you know. And then you come back together, and what did you learn? And, well, what did I learn, you know, and have that discussion there. It seems strange to me that people treat RT as though it were absolutely unique in being a state-run outlet and in, therefore, putting forward the views of the country of Russia in that sense, or being slow to be critical of the state that owns them. But the truth is, around the world, there are plenty of media outlets that are run by the state. They are good, bad, and indifferent. And again, it's just another kind of outlet that you need to be aware of who owns it when you're watching it. You may need to take certain things with a grain of salt, but you need to do that not just when you're watching RT, but also when you're watching ABC News. Same thing.
Exactly. I mean, isn't BBC funded by the government? You know, they don't call it state-run, but...
Exactly.
You know.
And we're not talking about it being propaganda and you shouldn't be allowed to watch it. You know, it's all just part of this enemy of the month thing that we're living through. You know, tomorrow it might be, you know, Spain. Who knows? When they point out an official enemy, and then we're all supposed to get in line hating that place and those people. I don't think
right.
people should allow themselves to be commandeered in that way. Your brain is your own. you know, and you
it becomes very Orwellian, you know, just like the it was 1 hour of hate you had
exactly.
in 1984.
Exactly. And, we're going to sit and have our 2 minutes hate where we get mad at North Korea. Okay, it's North Korea. You know, Syria. Okay. You know, people need to slow it up. You know, inform yourselves independently. Don't simply watch one TV show or read one paper and think you've got it all. But this whole thing of trying to brand some outlets fake and some legitimate, I think is a very slippery slope. All news comes from somewhere. You just need to think about where it's coming from.
Well, we're kind of coming to the close of our time here, and I wanted to make sure that we covered some of the, I guess, lighter notes and on media.
Well, tell me the good news.
I don't know. I mean, the thing is, you know, I wanted us to talk about like some movies and some commercials and stuff. And the thing is, like, I realized that like even the next movie that I'm going to go to is very serious. Like later today, I'm going to go to a screening for the new Laura Poitras documentary about Julian Assange. And I know that it's not like necessarily light. I started thinking about, well, you know, what are the things that I'm kind of looking forward to in terms of movies? I had been kind of going through kind of this withdrawal around Game of Thrones. I was kind of late to the party with Game of Thrones because when I saw the previews, it just wasn't very appealing to me at all. At the time, I was really immersed in Boardwalk Empire. That was another HBO series that was on weekly and had like a black angle to it. It was kind of set in Atlantic City during Prohibition. So it followed these kind of gangsters. But, you know, it's a large black community in Atlantic City. So I was kind of into that when they started previewing Game of Thrones and they showed some of the characters and stuff. And I said, oh, no, I'm not interested in that at all, you know. But my son, he piqued my interest. And so at some point, like last year, I like binge watched like all of Game of Thrones and watched the series as it unfolded. So I was kind of interested in like that coming on in June, but I'm starting to kind of rethink my allegiance to spending my time watching that. But, you know, it is entertainment.
There's a whole lot to watch there, you know, and you can get lost in it. And all your friends are talking about it and you kind of want to be part of it. You know, my thing along those lines is the superhero shows. Like Luke Cage, for example. The first time I watched Luke Cage, I'm 10 minutes in, I turned to my husband, I said, it's so black. You know, that show is black people and black producers behind the scenes, you know, and on screen. I just love it. And it is, you know, it's a superhero, but he's a black superhero. And I didn't realize how rare it was until I was 10 minutes in thinking, wait a minute, everybody, he's black, she's black, she's black too, the police chief is black, and this person. You know, I didn't realize how rare it is to see a show just filled with African-American people, and every time I watch it, I get kind of a special excitement. I like the show itself, but I also really appreciate what's going on there, and that folks who aren't used to seeing a show, you know, they're used to a show where there's the black friend or there's the black waitress, and, you know, that's the normal. And to see this kind of thing where black people are just in it from tip to tail is really kind of exciting for me.
Well, maybe next month, if I can convince you to come back, we can talk about this kind of new TV landscape, because there are a lot of shows that are on maybe cable channels, or they're on Netflix, or they're on a lot of media that not everyone either has access to, or they don't have access to the promotion about the shows to even know about them. And so there are a number of shows that, like you said, you know, you're talking about a show that I'm sure a lot of people don't know about, that we can talk a little bit about that. Because, I mean, it's something that I need to learn more about. For more than a decade, I wrote about film. And I know now I don't really want to like have to like go to a movie. You know, I want to go because it's just something I want to do. And similarly, you know, it's very difficult to keep up with the TV landscape and how much it's changing and what it offers.
I think that's true. And, you know, I would be interested because I don't find out about things till they're over. They're mm-hmm. already finished, and then I can go back and watch it all at once. I often hear people talking about something, and I don't know what they're talking about. And they, aren't you a media critic? Yes, but not, you know, entertainment television. I am not on the loop on a number of things. And I do think that there are lots of things that would be great, that I would love, that other folks would love to see, but we just don't know about them, and we don't know how to get to them. So I would appreciate learning myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. I missed the screening for the new series, The Handmaid's Tale, based on Margaret Atwood's novel, and that's on Netflix. And so I know that that's on. And I was actually surprised I had to kind of go back. And only when I went back did I realize, oh, this is a TV series. This isn't a movie. So,
yeah, it's confusing, right? You don't know what things are long form. But again, The Handmaid's Tale, when am I going to be in the mood to sit down and watch The Handmaid's Tale, you know, even if it's very good? Sometimes I do use media to escape, you know.
Exactly, exactly.
We're living The Handmaid's Tale. I don't need to go home and watch it on TV, you know. But I do appreciate when people make art that tries to grapple, you know, with real things.
Yeah,
and if you can do it in a way that draws people in so that they're entertained, but then also given something to think about, well, that's the sweet spot.
Well, on that note, we're going to wrap up. I've been speaking with Janine Jackson, Program Director of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, and she's host of the weekly radio show Counterspin. Thank you for joining me, Janine.
It's been my pleasure.
Yeah. Ooh, yeah. Are you really what we see on the outside? And hiding what you really are on the inside? Pretend.
Sampad. I'm from Boston. I'm a physician at Massachusetts General Hospital, and I'm here really for three reasons. So science has always had its detractors, but we're reaching a point right now in this country where it has opposition to science has practically become national policy. And that reflects a lot in the budget proposals, in the people who have been appointed to run the various agencies that are responsible for American scientific studies. And so we're here to make our voices heard that this is a problem.
If you're just tuning in, this is On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital. I'm Esther Avaram, and on Saturday, I had a chance to hear voices offstage at the March for Science, which was a kickoff to this entire week of actions in D.C. leading to Saturday's Tomorrow's People's Climate March. So we'll hear voices in the trenches of hospitals, of saving an environment for humans. And I heard from students and about science whistleblowers who have saved humanity in many cases. So let's go back to those voices.
Is that general distrust of science among in the population at large has reached some pretty alarming rates. And it's true across the political spectrum. You know, whether it's opposition to vaccines or oppositions to climate change, people have come to think of science not as a discipline whose job is to find objective data, but as a belief system that you're free to say, I don't believe in it. And trying to get the word out that, no, this is not a partisan issue. This is not, you know, about politics or about one party versus the other. This is not about one belief system versus the other. This is something that works for, this is a knowledge discipline for the entirety of humanity. And then the third reason is because there aren't nearly as many people who work in science or in medicine who are working in politics. We're good at being in the labs and in the hospitals, but lawyers and business people are the ones who are running the government, and there need to be more of us. And so that's why we're out here.
Okay. Have you seen the policies, the new policies, affect your work? Tell me a little bit about the work you do.
Sure. So I work in hospital medicine. I'm a physician. The policies have just started to come in and have not yet, those effects have not yet been downstream. But especially the distrust of science, the biggest place that I'm seeing it is in the children I take care of. I'm a duly trained internist and pediatrician. I've had many parents who come to me with questions about vaccines. And they're well-meaning. They want to do right by their children. But there are parties out there that are seeding, that are sowing seeds of doubt. And as a result, people don't know who to believe.
All right, well, thank you. Thank you for coming down here.
Thank you.
Lynn Scarlett, I'm Managing Director of Public Policy at the Nature Conservancy, and science is so much at the base of every solution that we try to do on the ground to advance conservation. So we're here to celebrate science. We're also here to educate. We have 600 scientists as part of our team, so they're here to talk about sustainable food, sustainable oceans, climate, and a lot of other topics.
So I understand that the scientists feel that their work is endangered under the current policies, but at the same time, the organizers for the march want to make sure that it's known that this isn't about a partisan event. So talk a little bit about the dangers and how scientists are trying to make sure that it's not thought of as a partisan issue.
So science serves everyone, every walk of life, all parties, and in that sense, the main focus is celebrating science. At the same time, there's a recognition that some science research is in peril if major cuts in funding occur through the federal government and otherwise. So the focus is not on the partisan politics, but really to say, stand up and be counted. We need to fund that science. Don't let that evaporate. So in that sense, there's some politics, but not some partisan politics.
But there are issues in terms of, for example, climate denial, all right? My understanding is that 98% of scientists agree that climate change is real, that it's impacting us. But the administration seems to have, the current administration seems to have a policy that doesn't recognize that. So whether scientists like it or not, they're thrust right in the center of national policy and debate. Oh, it's not really a debate. I hate people when they say that. It's not a debate at this point, but certainly policy.
You know, not only do scientists, 97-98% say climate is a challenge, it's real, and by the way, it's not in the future, the challenges are now. And of course, the Nature Conservancy is busily at work trying to apply our science and our solutions to address the climate challenges. At the same time, the American public also, when you look at polls, Republicans, Democrats, the majority also say, gee, this is a problem, we need to act. So part of what this event is about, not laser focused on climate, but partly focused on climate, is to sort of elevate the awareness by decision makers, all decision makers, that people care, that it counts, that they want action. So, you know, it's possible to be a voice, and yet not an adversarial voice, really more a voice of education and trying to put something front and center stage so that people have the will to act.
So what do you hope to happen after today's event?
Well, of course, the Nature Conservancy is 60 years old. We keep at our job of trying to bring about solutions, whether it's sustainable food or climate. But what I would hope happens is that through the 400-plus events going on to celebrate science, there is a sort of a follow-on drumbeat of support for science funding, an elevation in the headlines that science matters, that climate matters, that we need to act, and that decision makers see that, absorb that, and get the will to proceed and help us solve the problems that we face and for which science is critical to help.
Yeah. So the will, that will part. So there's some visits to Congress, perhaps as part of this coming week, or what are some of the things after today?
You know, I think each group will take its own set of actions. The Nature Conservancy is always a voice for science, so we're always up on the Hill saying this science is important. We need to fund this work. We will continue to do that, and not only climate science, but science that pertains to food safety, soil health, coastal resilience, and so on. And I think you'll see similar action by a lot of the groups that are here. But, you know, it's also important for members of Congress to hear from their constituents, not from organized groups, but from folks in their communities saying, you know what, all this science has helped us solve our food problems, it advances medical improvements, it really is about prosperity and the well-being of human beings, and we can't leave it behind.
Yeah. You know, I cover environmental issues, science issues from time to time on my show, and I think that a lot of times people start to feel overwhelmed, like there's really nothing they can do, that this is a big, beautiful planet, and that we've wrecked it, and that things are just out of control. Everything, like we get email about the bees, we get email about the ice melting at the Arctic. So what are some of the things that they can do to feel like they can take agency to make a difference?
So, you know, some of the problems that we face, and climate is one of them, really require all hands on deck, from big global action to national action to the actions we take as individuals in our own communities and backyards. So in your own community, step up, push for your local community to invest in and use solar and renewable energy, for example. In your own home, use those efficient light bulbs. I mean, there's just a whole series of things. Take public transit if it's feasible for you. Every little step we do contributes, but then also it's important to use your voice with your lawmakers, whether it's your mayor, whether it's your state legislators, whether it's your national or federal legislators, saying, this is important to me, you need to act. Because maybe one voice won't change the whole narrative, but if everybody does that, or lots and lots of people do that, they will take action.
You know, I play this game with myself sometimes if I'm challenged around recycling, and especially around recycling and doing things like that or driving my car. I say I'm 1 in 7 billion, so maybe this one little plastic doesn't seem like a lot right now, but if 7 billion people threw away the same piece of plastic, that would be a whole mountain, right? So I know that is a game I play with myself to remind myself to be a responsible, you know, Earth citizen.
You know, it's a really good game to play. I mean, think of that plastic. That one plastic piece of waste that you might throw away or just discard on the street gets into the sewer system, it gets into the streams, it ultimately gets into the ocean, and guess what? We now have, for example, in the Pacific Ocean, this mountainous pile of plastic, and it all started somewhere in someone's backyard.
Exactly. Was it the size of a state or something?
I forget the current dimensions, but it's enormous. It's called the plastic gyre. And it's just out there floating around. And, you know, it starts somewhere. And so those actions that each of us take really do matter. And the same is true with energy efficiency, using that efficient light bulb. That just helps cumulatively when you do it, when your neighbor does it, when your neighborhood does it. It matters.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
My name is Jasmine Jones. I'm a junior biology major at Howard University, and I'm from New Orleans, Louisiana. And I'm here today because, being a biology major, I do care about the environment, especially climate change specifically. And so I'm out here today just basically to help with Cool Effects. This is my first time working with them, and they've been super nice and super helpful and informative, and just trying to get the word out about the some projects that they are involved in, that they have funded, and just to connect with different people who are involved in science and talk about climate change specifically, because that is a big problem we're having. Cool Effects brought to my attention that 2016 was the hottest year in D.C. so far. So it's important to know that these are facts. Climate change is real, and it is going to get worse if we don't start doing something about it. So I think this march is extremely important.
So tell me more about the Louisiana wetlands. Most people know about Hurricane Katrina. They know that Louisiana is at a low sea level and that it's very threatened by climate change. What's your personal kind of connection to that?
Well, in seventh grade, my science teacher actually got me involved in his project, was for the Louisiana wetlands. And he brought us to different parts of the wetlands, kind of outside of New Orleans, more Destrehan, Louisiana, kind of the river parish is where it floods bad, you know. So we went out there and we looked at it and we just learned different things about the wetlands. I mean, we're losing football fields worth of land every year. And we would go out there and we would put plants, like we would plant trees along the shore to kind of like rebuild the wetlands. Lands, different things like that. But being that we're losing so much and erosion is happening, it's important because that's the only thing that's protecting the houses. So when hurricanes come, if you don't have any wetlands, it's going to go straight to the houses. And so that's where, you know, the pumping systems, different things like that come in. They have to be more prepared because we are losing these wetlands. But if we were just informed about the wetlands and not informed about pumping systems and different things like that, maybe we could help, you know, along, you know, just help and combat that so that we're not just building pumping systems. We can actually build the wetlands. Because once you lose it, you can't get it back. We can only protect what we have so far.
And is any of your work as a biology major connected to climate change?
Not at the moment. You know, I have been volunteering, like, in our greenhouse, because Howard University has a greenhouse at the top of the biology department building. But other than that, not really, not so far. I haven't really gotten in touch with any nonprofit like Cool Effects before. So just to be here today, it kind of opened my eyes to how much there is in D.C. that I can work with and just learn about more with helping in D.C. So, yeah.
My name is Christopher Polanco, and I'm here with Cool Effect, just trying to influence change and a positive view on what we're trying to do. Everyone has a ton of reasons, which is our slogan, a ton of reasons of why we want to influence climate change. And mine, frankly, is my sister's kids. We should leave the planet better than the way we left it. And if we continue in this trend of ignorance and distorting facts, nothing's ever going to be accomplished, and we aren't going to have much of a future to look forward to.
I see. That's what your sign says. My name is Chris, and my reason to save the earth is my sister's kids. So where are you from?
I'm actually from New York originally, moved here, been in D.C. for 10 years now.
And where are your sister's kids?
My sister's kids are all in New York.
Okay. So how did you first get involved with this? Where is Cool Effect based?
Well, that's actually a great question. I actually heard of this from a friend and decided to come in and help out and participate. But I know that they're a year in. They're relatively new, and they have a bunch of projects inside of crowdfunding projects that affects change that you can actually crowdfund so that these projects can be created. One of the cool ones is actually Productive Poo. I don't know if you saw that one inside.
What is productive poo?
That's actually using cow poo and a way to make more, you know, efficient energy.
Okay.
So really cool stuff. And you can crowdfund. It's really exciting.
All right. Thank you.
My name is Casey. I'm from Washington State. And I'm out here because science is important. The anti-intellectualism that's going on in America right now, it's pretty heinous. I mean, we can't function as a society if we don't have a solid grasp on what is real and what's not. And I think it's a huge disservice to people to try and discredit institutions that would try and advance that sphere of knowledge that we currently have.
Are you a scientist?
No, I'm just a fan, you know. I work as an electronics technician, so I use a lot of science in what I do, a lot of math. But this is important.
What are some of the issues up in Washington State? I do know there was an issue of a dam or was it a nuclear plant. What are some of the issues in Washington State that people are concerned about related to climate and science?
Well, I mean, there's the Hanford Nuclear Reservation. It's where they processed a lot of the nuclear material after the, well, during the Cold War. It's a huge Superfund site, and there's a lot of stuff up there that needs to get cleaned up. But I mean, just conservationism there in general. The budget that currently, well, was recently proposed by the president cuts a lot of funding for environmental research up there. And that's a big problem. I mean, you can't get better if you don't measure. You know, you can't know if you're improving if you don't know where you've been. So cutting down on those efforts is going to do us a lot of harm in the long run.
Tell me your name, where you're from, and why you came out here today in a dinosaur.
Yeah, well, I'm Kate Jonas. I'm a student at UNC Chapel Hill, and a big group of us came out to support science, and I work on coral reefs in the Caribbean, so I am more interested in encouraging sustainability in our resources and in our earth and what we have and keeping it real, so that's why I'm here. And
what are the real dangers that you see right now?
Well, the biggest is the carbon, CO2 pollution. I think we can use renewable resources, and we should be 100% reliant on that. That's my number one.
Right. Because I know there was a story recently about bleaching of the coral reefs, and they were showing one, I guess, high school student class or a college student class, and everybody just started to cry when they saw the pictures.
Yeah.
How big of a part does that play, the destruction of the reefs in terms of the ocean's viability?
Well, coral reefs represent 1% of the ocean, and they support a huge biomass of fish, and they contribute to fisheries management and keeping fish alive and keeping our well-being intact, because the ocean is a bigger role in oxygen for our atmosphere. So let's put carbon in it and reduce all the oxygen we have. So we're pretty much strangling ourselves here. They're getting to that point, so that's what I don't want to see.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you, and thank you for your demonstration.
Enthusiasm?
Yeah, enthusiasm. Okay.
Those were voices from the first ever March for Science, which was a lead up to the People's Climate March for 2017 happening April 29th here in Washington, D.C.
That will do it for today's show. Thanks again to Gerald Horn and Janine Jackson. Also, thanks to Chantel James, Michelle Roberts, and Michael Byfield for their reporting for today's show. Thanks to our engineer, Michael Nasella, and thank you for listening. You can reach the show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can listen to all of our shows. You can also hear On the Ground on iTunes under WPFW Pacifica Radio. Please like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On the Ground Radio Show. I'm Esther Averam. Keep raising your voice. Peace.